Somebody said that the US Constitution was written by geniuses so that the country could be run by idiots. And I think we're in such a moment now, and we were certainly in it in October 1962, when President Kennedy had to take a series of decisions that could have resulted in a nuclear war.
Welcome to the Miller Center Forum. I'm Christina Lopez-Guattardi, and our guest today is Michael Dobbs. Michael Dobbs was a reporter for the Washington Post for 25 years, first as a foreign correspondent, representing the newspaper in Belgrade, Warsaw, Paris, and Moscow, covering the collapse of communism. Later, he serves as a Post diplomatic reporter and reporter on the national desk. Dobbs has held fellowships and visiting scholarships at Harvard and Princeton universities, the Woodrow Wilson Center for International Scholars, and most recently, the U.S. Institute of Peace, from where he conducted archival and interview research for his new book. He is the author of Down with Big Brother, The Fall of the Soviet Empire, Saboteurs, The Nazi Raid on America, Madeleine Albright, and most recently, 1 Minute to Midnight, Kennedy, Khrushchev, and Castro on the Brink of Nuclear War, which takes a fresh look at the history of the Cuban Missile Crisis and draws lessons for today's presidents based on this dramatic case. He'll be discussing this book today. Please join me in welcoming Michael Dobbs.
Thank you very much, Christina. Well, since the election is just over, I thought I'd begin with a quote from Joe Biden. You may remember a couple of weeks ago, this is what he said. Mark my words, it will not be 6 months before the world tests Barack Obama like they did John Kennedy. The world is looking. We're about to elect a brilliant 47-year-old senator, president of the United States of America. Remember, I said it here, standing here. Watch, we're going to have an international crisis, a generated crisis, to test the mettle of this guy. And he's going to have to take some really tough decisions. Now, he was referring, of course, actually not just to the Cuban Missile Crisis, which took place in October 1962, 2 years after JFK was elected president, but a series of crises that preceded it, including the Bay of Pigs, the failed Bay of Pigs invasion of Cuba in 1961, and the failed Vienna summit between Khrushchev and Kennedy a couple of months later. It's wonderful to be talking about the missile crisis at the Miller Center. The Miller Center has done some great work into transcribing presidential tapes, transcribing the tapes of the ExCom meetings that President Kennedy held with his advisors during the 13 days of the missile crisis. And those tapes are a wonderful resource because they put you in the room with the president and his advisors as he was taking some extraordinary decisions. But I think they're a blessing and a curse. They're a blessing because they give historians and readers a degree of access that is very rare in understanding an international crisis. But they're also a curse because people have focused, I think, too much on the tapes at the expense of everything else that was happening in and around Cuba. And what I tried to do in my book was to look not just at the debates in the Oval Office and the White House and the decisions that were being taken by the president, but what was happening elsewhere. And when you put the two things together, you see that the debates, what the president is being told, doesn't always mesh with what is happening in the rest of the world. There is misinformation coming into the White House. There are things that the president doesn't know and doesn't understand. And what I tried to do in my book is to, by having a very detailed day by day, hour by hour, and sometimes minute by minute narrative, you see the gap between what the president knows and what is really happening. So it's important that we draw the right lessons from the missile crisis. I think it's been wrapped up with mythology for many, many years. And I certainly, during the course of my research, found out a lot of things I didn't know and drew lessons that are in many ways run counter to the lessons drawn by other historians. Somebody said that the US Constitution was written by geniuses so that the country could be run by idiots. And I think that is often the case, but the United States is such a resilient country that it often doesn't matter who is in the Oval Office. But there are moments in history when it's of vital importance. If it takes on an importance of, does the country go to war, or does it remain at peace? Issues of life and death are decided, and I think we're in such a moment now, and we were certainly in it in October 1962, when President Kennedy had to take a series of decisions that could have resulted in a nuclear war or backing away from a nuclear war. So I just want to begin with a little bit of background about the crisis. Of course, during the election campaign that's just over, we heard a lot of talk about the famous 3 a.m. moment when the president would be awoken by his closest national security aide with a new foreign policy crisis, perhaps in Iran, and have to make a snap decision. Well, in the case of the missile crisis, the 3 a.m. moment actually occurred at 8 a.m. in the morning, because the previous night, on October 16th, 1962, the CIA had discovered that the Soviets had done something that they said they were never going to do, namely to deploy nuclear missiles on Cuba, just less than 100 miles from American shores. And the president had to make a decision about what to do about it. But there had been a debate about the type of military equipment the Soviets were sending to Cuba. That debate was finally resolved on October 15th. The president's national security advisor was briefed, and he decided that there was nothing the president could do about it that night, and that the best thing would be to let the president get a good night's sleep. So there was no 3 a.m. moment. He informed the president the next day at 8 o'clock in the morning. Then the president had to make a decision. His first instinct was to bomb the missile sites, which would probably have led to a US invasion of Cuba. But instead, he decided on a fallback position, a quarantine or a naval blockade of the island. He went on television on October 22nd to, in effect, give the Soviets an ultimatum. They had to withdraw their missiles from Cuba. Half of my book is devoted to one single day, October the 27th, the culminating day of the missile crisis, the day I think the world came closer to nuclear destruction than ever before or since. And so I want to describe a few of the things that happened that day. On around about lunchtime on October the 27th, the Joint Chiefs of Staff, including the Air Force Chief, Curtis LeMay, made a formal recommendation to the president to attack the missile sites. They said time was running out. We can't risk the Soviets were about to make these weapons operational. Time was running out. We can't afford to delay any longer. And we should attack the missile sites, and we should follow up with an invasion of Cuba within 7 days. That was the formal advice the president was getting from the uniformed military. Now, had he followed that advice, I think the results would have been disastrous. The military had planned a full-scale invasion of the island. This is a photograph of a US reconnaissance plane entering Cuba at the height of the missile crisis. There are cameras in the bay of the plane, in the nose of the plane, and this photograph, which I found at the National Archives, among the raw intelligence film. It's never been published before, but the US reconnaissance planes would enter the island in pairs, and so sometimes from their oblique cameras, they would take shots of each other. And the plane here is flying over the beaches of northern Cuba that the US was planning to invade at this precise time. I also discovered a plan of the or reconnaissance photographs of Tarara Beach, west east of Havana, which was going to be the main assault beach for the amphibious landings of the U.S. Marines. The Marines were going to invade across a east and west of Havana, at Tarara Beach east east of Havana, and at Mariel to the west. It's very similar, actually, in scale to the D-Day landings in Normandy during the Second World War, involving about 100,000 U.S. troops along a 100-mile front. So you can imagine the scale of this operation that was being planned. The landing craft, the ships, were all off Cuba with the Marines and the other American U.S. units ready to invade the island at the president's command. But when the president received this formal advice from his military leaders, there were many things that he didn't know. In fact, when I did all the research into my book, you know, the question that came up in my mind was not the Watergate question of what did the president know and when did he know it. The real question I had was what didn't the president know? Because what he didn't know turns out to be much more significant than what he did know. So I'll just tell you a few of the things he didn't know at the time or he was misinformed about when he received this advice from the Joint Chiefs. He was told by the CIA that there were between 6,000 to 8,000 Soviet troops on Cuba. In fact, at that time, there were 43,000 Soviet troops, heavily armed combat troops on Cuba. In other words, 6 to 8 times the number of Soviet troops on Cuba than the president had been led to believe. Furthermore, they were armed not just with the nuclear missiles that could hit the United States. They also were also equipped with short-range cruise missiles and ballistic missiles that would have been used against a U.S. invading force of Cuba. They were aimed at these beaches, at Tarara Beach, at the other landing beaches along the northern coast. They were also aimed, as I demonstrate in my book, at the Guantanamo Naval Base. In fact, the preceding night, on the night of October 26th, 27th, the Soviets sent a convoy of nuclear cruise missiles up to the periphery of the naval base to within a position 15 miles from the naval base, and the U.S. naval base at Guantanamo could have been wiped out in about 5 minutes. The president also didn't know about the nuclear warheads. He had been told where the missile sites were because we'd photographed the missile sites. But the key question was, where were the warheads? Because the missiles could not be fired until the warheads were brought to the missile sites and actually mated with the missiles. And that was a question that the CIA was not able to answer at all during the missile crisis. And it's only many years later, and partly as the result of the research that I did for my book, that we discovered exactly how the Soviets were handling their warheads on Cuba, where they were stored, and how they were dispersed around the island at the most critical stage of the crisis. The main Soviet nuclear storage bunker was at a place called Behukal, about 15 miles south of Havana. I discovered it first by talking to Soviet veterans who had served there and actually handled the warheads. And then I went back through all this raw intelligence film, and I discovered that the U.S. reconnaissance planes had actually photographed the site. This is the first photograph of the main Soviet nuclear warhead storage bunker at Behukal. Now, the CIA analysts took one look at this photograph and a series of other photographs, and they had suspected that it might have something to do with the storage of nuclear warheads. But they took one look at the security around the site. You can see it's just surrounded by a single, rather flimsy fence, and there's practically no security at the main entrance there at the bottom left of the picture. And they compared that with the photographs they'd seen of similar installations in the Soviet Union and dismissed this as a possible nuclear warhead storage site. But I've been able to demonstrate, I think, that this was indeed the place where the Soviets kept their nuclear warheads. And the key to identifying it are these warhead vans that you see on the right-hand side of the picture. The warheads themselves were stored underground in a bunker, but the vans would have taken the warheads from this site to the missile sites for arming the missiles. This is a photograph of an overhead photograph on the same reconnaissance flight of those specially configured nuclear warhead storage vans. Actually, the giveaway is the configuration of the vans here. There were four vans for each of them would have carried, at each missile site, there were four launch positions. And so therefore they needed four warheads to mate with the four missiles aimed at the United States, and there were another two missiles in reserve that would have been fired had the first volley been successful. Then there's also a crane on the, you see in the photograph, that is actually, the purpose of which is to actually take the warheads out of the vans and install them on the missiles. So actually everything you need to know about the clue that this is a place associated with nuclear warheads is right here in this photograph, and the CIA missed it back in October 1962. On the night of October 26th to 27th, the Soviet commander on Cuba orders the dispersal of some of the warheads. He is convinced, as the Cubans are convinced, that time is running out and that they need to actually arm the missiles. So a convoy of trucks sets out from Bejucal to one of the missile sites at a place called Sagua La Grande to arm the missiles. President also completely unaware of what is going on. The president knew there were Soviet submarines in the vicinity. The US Navy was trying to bring them to the surface. What we didn't know was that these Soviet submarines in the Caribbean were also armed with nuclear torpedoes, and the conditions inside the submarines were which had come all the way across the Atlantic, the conditions in which the Soviet submariners lived were very, very strained, all the Soviet submariners were getting on each other's nerves and contemplating the use of nuclear torpedoes against the US Navy that was trying to bring them to the surface by throwing down practice depth charges. So the president had no idea of that. He didn't completely control his own forces, and I think the most dramatic example of that is this gentleman. His name is Chuck Maltsby. He was stationed at Alaska during the missile crisis, and he had a routine mission of flying to, he was meant to fly to the North Pole in order to gather radioactive samples from Soviet nuclear tests. Anyway, as chance would have it, he takes off from Alaska again on this very critical day, October the 27th, goes to the North Pole. He's blinded by the aurora borealis, and instead of coming back to Alaska as he was meant to, his navigation systems failed him, which were essentially navigating by the stars. And on the most dangerous day of the missile crisis, the most critical day of the Cold War, he ends up over the eastern part of the Soviet Union, the Chukotka Peninsula. I discovered a map in the National Archives that shows his precise route. The red lines that you see on this map are Soviet MiGs, fighters, that are going up trying to shoot him down. He realizes where he is for the first time when he starts hearing Russian music coming over his radio. He figures that something is wrong. The MiGs can only reach 50,000 feet. He is flying at 72,000 feet. So he's able to fly above these the MiGs that are trying to shoot him down. The These are all Washington times that I've put on the map. One of the key questions here is I show, you know, when he entered Soviet territory, when he left, he's over Soviet territory for about an hour and a quarter. The president is not told that a U-2 is missing over the Soviet Union until Maltsby has already left Soviet territory. And his reaction when he hears about it is, there's always some son of a bitch who doesn't get the word. A rather sort of laconic reaction. In the meantime, the Strategic Air Command has scrambled F-102s armed with nuclear weapons also from Galeno Air Force Base. There's a possibility of a confrontation over the Bering Straits between the American F-102s and the Soviet MiGs. And this is actually really when we needed Sarah Palin on the job, looking out from Alaska and monitoring this very dangerous confrontation over the Bering Straits. But she wouldn't be around for several decades later. Also on the night, on the same day, the night of October 26th, 27th, Fidel Castro is convinced that an American attack is imminent. He goes to the Soviet embassy in Havana and sends a telegram to Khrushchev, essentially telling him that the U.S. is about to invade the island and that in the event of a U.S. invasion of Cuba, he advises Khrushchev to use nuclear weapons against the United States to settle, liquidate, as he puts it, the imperialist menace once and for all. So this is the background. All this Kennedy doesn't know when he has to take this decision as to whether to follow the Joint Chiefs' advice and launch an invasion of Cuba. At the same time, he receives another letter from Nikita Khrushchev, essentially offering him a deal. Khrushchev says, okay, we will withdraw our missiles from Cuba if you withdraw your analogous missiles from Turkey. The U.S. had deployed Jupiter missiles, intermediate range Jupiter missiles in Turkey a few months before. Every person in the room is opposed to that deal. The only person in the room who thinks it's a reasonable offer or the reasonable basis for an agreement is the president himself. The National Security Advisor says this will ruin our relations with Turkey. It will destroy the cohesion of NATO. But Kennedy's argument is different. He says, I'm not going to go to war over a bunch of obsolete missiles in Turkey. If we're going to have a nuclear war, I need to be able to explain this, give a very good explanation to the American people. And a few obsolete missiles in Turkey is not a sufficient reason to go to war. So one of the myths about the missile crisis is that Kennedy ignored that letter from Khrushchev. He didn't ignore it. He finessed it by sending his brother Bobby to the Soviet embassy in Washington on the night of October 27th and essentially, first of all, telling the Soviets that they had to withdraw their missiles from Cuba, that time was running out, but also promising to withdraw U.S. missiles from Turkey within a couple of months. And that was the settlement that eventually led to the resolution of the crisis. Now, Kennedy made many mistakes. There was the mistake of meeting Khrushchev at Vienna a few months after he became president. He allowed Khrushchev to bury him, to bully him. Khrushchev formed a very poor impression of Kennedy. He said he was too weak and too intellectual. Then there was the mistake of the Bay of Pigs, in which was essentially an operation planned by the Eisenhower administration. Kennedy allowed himself to be talked into. Then there was the whole fiasco of the secret war against Castro called Operation Mongoose, which was completely ineffective. But the message it sent to Castro and Kennedy and Khrushchev was that the Kennedys were out to get Castro and they had to do something dramatic in order to save the Castro regime in Cuba. So there are all these mistakes that Kennedy made. But at the critical moment, when all his advisors were telling him to do something else, and he was the one person in the room that, if you read the transcripts of these XCOM tapes or listen to the meetings themselves, which are all on the Miller Center website, by the way, you can see that the president was the one person in the room who was most determined to avoid slipping into a nuclear war. So what were the qualities in the president that enabled him to take this decision? You know, this is a debate that occurred during the election campaign. Is it experience? Is it judgment? I think it's a mixture of the two. Kennedy's experience played a vital role. First of all, he had served in the military during the Second World War. He had an instinctive feel for what I call that son of a bitch moment, when things go wrong. And in order, I think, even though he served in a fairly junior capacity, he was only a lieutenant junior grade out in the South Pacific, that gave him insights into the way in which, you know, orders of the commander-in-chief are not automatically transmitted down to the people at the bottom, that things can go wrong. He'd also had the experience of things going wrong in his own presidency, particularly at the Bay of Pigs, which taught him to be a lot more cautious about the accepting the advice of the military. Had the missile crisis occurred the first year of the presidency, his reaction might have been very different. Thankfully, he had learned quite a bit on the job. So it was a combination of that experience with his own judgment and temperament. In the end, I think Kennedy and Khrushchev, in different ways, end up on the same side. The big threat of war in October 1962, in the end, did not come from the confrontation between the two men. They had brought the world to the brink of nuclear war through their mistakes, but they then found a way to walk back from the brink. I think the real risk of nuclear war was the one that Kennedy understood instinctively, even though he didn't know all the details that I've just told you. He understood that there was the real risk came from these sort of accidental moments, the possibility that he and Khrushchev were losing control of events, didn't completely control their own forces. And you know, there's been the way in which the missile crisis has been studied for the last three or four decades. You may have heard of Graham Allison's book, Essence of Decision, which talks about rational actors. I think what the missile crisis illustrates is the importance of the irrational actors, the Chuck Maltzbys, who get lost at the most critical moment, the son of a bitch moments. It illustrates not it's not a case study in crisis management as it's been built up to be in many analyses. It's a case study in the limits of crisis management. So at the end, you have Kennedy and Khrushchev pretty much on the same side. And I'd just like to conclude by reading something that a letter that Jackie Kennedy wrote to Khrushchev after JFK's assassination a year later. "You and he were adversaries," Jackie tells Khrushchev, "but you were allied in a determination that the world should not be blown up. The danger which troubled my husband was that war might be started not so much by the big men as by the little ones. While big men know the need for self-control and restraint, little men are sometimes moved more by fear and pride." And I think that in October 1962, in the ultimate analysis, Khrushchev and Kennedy proved themselves to be big men. The real danger of war came from the little men. And I hope that that's a lesson that our future leaders are going to understand. Thank you very much.
Well, let me begin the conversation by asking, past accounts of the Cuban Missile Crisis pay little attention to the role that Fidel Castro played. He's portrayed essentially as a marginal player. And at the same time, he's also, perhaps of the three leaders, the most irrational and perhaps the most dangerous, as evidenced by his letter to Khrushchev on Black Saturday, where he urges him to possibly launch a preemptive nuclear attack. You also conclude that of the three players that following the missile crisis, that he was one of the big winners, in the sense that what followed was over four decades of his rule, whereas Kennedy, as we know, was assassinated just over a year later, and Khrushchev goes out of power in 1964, in part because of his role in Cuba. Can you share your thoughts on this?
Well, he was irrational in the sense that he was the one leader of those three who was really prepared to contemplate a nuclear war being fought not just somewhere in the world, but actually on Cuban soil. I mean, I think the plans to use tactical nuclear missiles on the island of Cuba were very closely coordinated between Castro and the Soviet commanders on the island. In fact, Raul Castro was in eastern Cuba. He was in eastern Cuba in Oriente province, coordinating with the Soviets the possible attack on the Guantanamo naval base. Of course, from Fidel's point of view, what seems irrational to other people, from his point of view, was rational, because he thought the best way of defending his revolution was to take a position of complete intransigence vis-a-vis the United States. And, you know, it's the kind of madman theory of international relations, that he would be the madman and that would be a deterrent to an invasion of the island. Of course, as you say, one of the ironies is that he is, 40 years later, he is still there. Kennedy was assassinated the following year. Khrushchev was deposed by his Politburo colleagues 2 years later, in part because of his miscalculations during the missile crisis. And Fidel is there with his brother more than four decades later. I think the missile crisis did guarantee Fidel's hold on power, because one of the guarantees that the U.S. had given was that they wouldn't invade the island if the Soviets withdrew their missiles. And in effect, that bargain was kept. The missile crisis was the end of active U.S. attempts to overthrow Castro by force.
Very interesting presentation, and certainly a great reminder of some of the problems we may have today. One thing I'd like to ask you about, though, I have a cousin who happened to have been involved in this rather dramatic presentation, and that's Llewellyn Thompson. He was not really mentioned by you during this, but I think he played a rather important role with President Kennedy.
Right.
Could you describe that?
Sure. Llewellyn Thompson was a former U.S. ambassador to the Soviet Union who was recruited by Kennedy to join the EXCOM, the executive committee of his closest advisors, during the course of the missile crisis. So really, Thompson was, insofar as the U.S. was able to understand the motivations of the Soviet leadership, was through people like Llewellyn Thompson. Llewellyn Thompson was the Soviet expert on the EXCOM. And I think that he helped Kennedy understand, you know, because he had met many times with Khrushchev himself. He gave the president insights into Khrushchev's character and motivations that contributed to a peaceful resolution of the crisis. You know, many of the people take different positions, and if you look at the tapes, you know, one day Llewellyn Thompson takes a hawkish position, one day a dovish position, but I think in general he did a lot to, his main contribution was increasing the president's understanding of the way in which the Soviet mind worked and the way in which Khrushchev's mind worked.
Khrushchev's letter seems to be the key to the resolution of this crisis. Would you expand a little on any information that your investigation turned up that might shed some light on why and how he arrived at the decision to write that letter?
Well, he'd been writing a series of letters to Kennedy during the crisis. In fact, this is not like today when they could just pick up the phone and talk to the leader of the other side. It took 12 hours for communications between Moscow and Washington. The communications had to be put in code, sent across the Atlantic by cable, deciphered at the other end. So this is one of the problems. There wasn't instantaneous communication. Actually, as a result of the missile crisis, a hotline was introduced between Moscow and Washington, but it didn't exist in October 1962. Khrushchev, in his responses to Kennedy, I think he takes the decision pretty early on that the crisis will have to end with the withdrawal of Soviet missiles from Cuba. He understands that very early on. And in fact, he orders his ships to be turned around the first day. There's a myth out there that this eyeball-to-eyeball confrontation between the Soviet missile-carrying ships and the U.S. warships on the blockade. That actually didn't happen. Khrushchev had taken a very cautious position and turned his ships around the day before. But he wanted to extract the maximum possible bargaining price for removing the missiles from Cuba. He wanted to say that he had saved Castro and saved the socialism in Cuba. That was his bottom line. And he also wanted to get, what else could he get from it? So on Friday, the 26th, he's receiving sort of various signals that perhaps perhaps the U.S. would be willing to trade away those missiles in Turkey. So that encourages him to write another letter to Kennedy mentioning the Turkish missiles. So he's, it's basically sort of, it's a little like a rug merchant. He's trying to get the highest price he can, but he also understands that time is running out. And when he writes that letter, he is convinced, like Fidel is convinced, that a U.S. invasion is imminent. So that last letter is not sent through the usual diplomatic channels. They send it on, they read it out over the radio so that it will be received instantaneously in Washington. That letter and the letter the following day announcing the withdrawal of Soviet missiles from Cuba. So I think he takes a decision early on that the missiles must be removed, but then he's kind of maneuvering and bargaining for tactical advantage.
While Kennedy was being briefed about the situation in Cuba, he seemed to be the only one in the room that thought attacking Cuba would have been a bad idea, and he probably should not have had that as his first plan of action. What made all the other advisors in the room so willing to start a nuclear war?
Well, they didn't want to have a nuclear war, most of them, with the exception of the military, who thought we could actually win a nuclear war. And this is the last time in the post-war history that there are a significant group of people led by Curtis LeMay who think it's possible to win a nuclear war with the Soviet Union because we enjoy such superiority. And Kennedy, says, well, we could win a nuclear war, but is it worth winning? Supposing one missile gets through, what would be the consequences? 600,000 people would be killed. Americans would be killed if a missile landed near an American city. We might win this war, but we would lose 500,000 people. It's not worth it. But the other advisors, the civilian advisors, I think the difference between them and the president was that they were looking at the problem through kind of a narrow lens. The Secretary of State was thinking about U.S. relations with Turkey, the cohesion of NATO. The president was the only one with peripheral vision that was looking at the global problems. He was asking the bigger questions, what turn out to be the most important questions. Is it worth risking a nuclear war with the Soviet Union over these missiles in Turkey that we will probably end up dismantling in a few months anyway? So, I think it's Kennedy's character, but in part it's the nature of the presidency that you do see a whole array of problems that some of your advisors are just looking at parts of the problem.
Mr. Dobbs, I wonder how many other Americans are like me who recall that period very clearly and also remember that after the blockade ended, the statement that was most often cited was Dean Rusk's comment that I think we just saw the other guy blink.
Right.
Your book kind of contradicts the image that was created about the precedent of being a stalwart and unyielding and uncompromising and not willing to discuss further with an enemy and acting forthrightly. I find myself today with your book, many of these things I had not known, but I think more important perhaps in the son of a bitch moment is a question of how does America take from its previous history lessons about how to address issues like these when they might rise again?
Well, that's why I think it's important. I think the Cuban Missile Crisis has many contemporary lessons for us, but we have to draw the right lessons. And the way in which the missile crisis was taught was spun by the Kennedy administration and then taught for many years, I think is largely myth. And part of the myth is this image of the president staring down his opposite number in the Kremlin and forcing him to back down. You know, that there's a grain of truth in that, but it also misses a lot. The eyeball to eyeball, I mean, as you say, Dean Rusk quote on October the 24th, when supposedly the Soviet ships are still steaming towards the blockade. Has anybody seen the movie 13 Days? There's a whole scene in that movie of the Soviet ships moving toward the blockade line, the president having to take a decision, and at the last moment, the ships turning back, and Dean Rusk saying, "We were eyeball to eyeball, and the other fellow just blinked." And this kind of strengthened the image of Kennedy, which was carefully cultivated by the Kennedy people, of the American president staring down his opposite number in the Kremlin. Now, it didn't exactly happen like that. That I show in my book that Khrushchev took the decision about his remaining missile-carrying ships the same night that Kennedy went on TV, October 22nd. And Khrushchev gave the order for the ships to turn around and to head back to the Soviet Union. At the time Dean Rusk made that moment, I think he sincerely believed that the Soviet ships were in the vicinity of the American ships. I'm the first person who actually plotted the positions of the Soviet ships, at least the first researcher to plot the positions of the ships. And I found out, much to my astonishment, that at that precise moment, they were 800 nautical miles from the US ships steaming in the opposite direction. So the eyeball-to-eyeball moment didn't happen. It's a myth. Emphasizes the lesson I draw from this, which is that the real risk was not the eyeball-to-eyeball confrontation. It was from, you know, as you described it, the son-of-a-bitch moments and moments like it. Thank you.
Yes, I'm just curious to know what your perspective would be, having been on the Soviet side of the opinion of this. As far as the tactical, you mentioned the presence of tactical nuclear warheads in Cuba. What was the probability of them being deployed during a U.S. invasion? Cuba's not that big. You fire those at U.S. soldiers, chances are you're going to kill Soviet soldiers and Cuban civilians. Mm-hmm. Not something Castro, I don't know whether he would have, wouldn't have wanted it, but I mean, what would be your perspective on that?
Well, Khrushchev did reassert formally his authority over all nuclear weapons on Cuba, not just the ones that could reach the United States, but also the tactical nuclear weapons that could have been used against an American invading force. So it's true that the local Soviet commanders on Cuba did not have the formal authority to use those weapons against the Americans. But in the event of a U.S. invasion of Cuba, you know, first of all, the first thing that would have happened would have been communication links between Moscow and Cuba were already very poor, very difficult to get messages back and forth. The Soviet commanders on the island were taking various decisions on their own authority. For example, on October 27th, Black Saturday, they ordered the downing of a U.S. reconnaissance plane, a U-2 flying over the island, piloted by Major Anderson, who was the only combat casualty of the missile crisis. So they were taking decisions without necessarily clearing them with Moscow. There were no locks or codes on these missiles. So, for example, the convoy of cruise missiles that moved up towards Guantanamo was under the command of a captain who, had there been a breakout from Guantanamo, had there been an invasion, it's very easy to imagine communications being completely disrupted. He would have, in effect, the captain, in that case, would have had to take a decision about whether to use a nuclear weapon. Even though he did not have formal authority over it, he had complete control over it. He could have fired the thing within 5 minutes. I think that, you know, given the sheer number of tactical nuclear weapons on Cuba, there are about 100 of them. It was overkill. Had the U.S. invaded the island, of course, we might have been lucky that none of them would have been used. But talking to the Soviets who actually handled them, they think there's a high probability that one of them could be used. At any rate, it was a risk that was not worth running.
The other day, we had a talk by Phil Zelikow, who was director of the Miller Center at one time. And after the talk, there were some questions asked to him. And one of them was, how do you treat the dictators of this world in so far as speaking with dictators and communicating with them? And afterwards, I mentioned to Phil that this particular example that we have here, I think, is most critical. And that is that in the relationship that our ambassador had with Khrushchev, he was able to provide the solution for Kennedy to make. And to me, that seems to underline one of the big problems we have today insofar as our diplomacy with Iran and with Russia to a large extent, because we've got a dramatic crisis developing over there as well in regard to the missiles that are being installed in Poland or that we're threatening to install. I think we're actually putting them in. That, to me, looks like a threat against what might be considered their territory, just like we consider threats in South America contrary to the Monroe Doctrine. Mm-hmm. Don't you agree that the critical thing for us is to be able to establish against these things communications in such a way that we'll be able to help solve problems? I don't mean that we need to do this without agenda, but we need to do it. Mm-hmm. Do you agree?
Right. Well, of course, this is a question that was central to the foreign policy debate in the presidential election campaign, with Obama taking the view that we have to talk to our enemies, and the other side saying that you shouldn't talk to your enemies. Of course, actually, the Bush administration has moved from a policy of not talking to enemies to a policy of talking to some, at least some enemies, such as the leaders, such as North Korea. But I think the missile crisis illustrates both the risks and the opportunities of talking to, of dialogue. I mean, on the one hand, you're completely right that it was absolutely essential that we understood as best we could the motivations and the personalities on the other side, and that, you know, not only Thompson's knowledge of the Soviet leaders was extremely important. The fact that Kennedy had met Khrushchev was also important. But it also, I think, to be fair to the other side in this debate, it also, the missile crisis illustrates some of the risks of negotiating, without preconditions or without preparation. The Soviets, I think Kennedy himself regretted the meeting that he had with Khrushchev in Vienna a few months after he became president. Khrushchev ended up sort of bullying him, thinking that he could push Kennedy around. Kennedy, he has a talk with Jim Reston of the New York Times just after that meeting. And he tells Reston essentially that he has a big job to do to restore his credibility with Khrushchev. So I guess, you know, I come down to the position that Obama eventually arrived at, which is that meetings are good, dialogue is good, but it also has to be, you know, carefully prepared and thought out.
Thank you very much for an interesting talk. I'd like to just present briefly a somewhat contrarian reaction to this piece of history. We've been dancing around the question that the Kennedy folks took great pains to present this in the most favorable light and to further Kennedy's reputation in history. And I guess I feel that way. When I look at what has happened since that time and consider a book by Mel Leffler of the Miller Center, who has focused on five critical periods during the Cold War, what I find is that it is the senior leaders, the president of both Russia and the United States, and their highest diplomatic representatives who have made the important human decisions to avoid nuclear confrontation and ultimately reduce nuclear weapons. In that context, I really don't see the Kennedy accomplishment as terribly different or superior to what's happened since, with the exception that, of course, perhaps because of technology at that time, the context of the time, we did actually come closer to a nuclear exchange. Could you just comment on that?
Well, I don't say that you know, Kennedy is completely unique. I do think, however, that the stakes were higher than ever before in October 1962. I mean, when you can take decisions about going to war. If it's a conventional war, you can always recover from those decisions. In the case of nuclear war, the margin for error is very, very slim. And that was one of the things that Kennedy understood, was that he understood that, you know, if he made a mistake, we could end up with huge numbers of Soviets and Americans dead, I mean, in the hundreds and hundreds of thousands. And I think that served as a restraint on him. And this was different from deciding whether to escalate in Vietnam, for example, where you can take that, you can make a decision and the consequences, or even invading Iraq. In the case, in October 1962, the stakes were so high that had the president taken one decision rather than another decision, we could have ended up in a nuclear war. And I think that, you know, Kennedy, and perhaps other presidents would understand that as well, but Kennedy certainly did.
You conclude that the view from the Oval Office was very limited in 1962. Do you think that that remains the case today as much as it was then, or is the executive now better informed?
Well, in some ways, we're better informed. I mean, in some ways, we're not. It's not improved all that much. I mean, witness the case of WMD in Iraq. The president was told that it was a slam dunk case, that there was Saddam Hussein had weapons of mass destruction, and we discovered that he had destroyed his chemical arsenals a long time, many years previously. So the president was getting misinformation, perhaps, you know, whether or not he encouraged the intelligence people to give him the misinformation is another question, but you know, that is very reminiscent to me of a lot of the misinformation that was falling, that was coming into the Oval Office during the missile crisis. So although the technology has changed, the guy in the Oval Office is never going to understand completely what is going on, and I think that's one of the lessons from the missile crisis. The beginning of wisdom is really to understand that there's a lot that you don't know and a lot that you don't understand. I think Kennedy's great contribution to the great moment during those 13 days is the
evidence to our attention and for drawing.